Welcome to the podcast service of Sydney's FM 103.2, available on the web at fm1032.com.au.
In 1987, Terry Waite travelled to Lebanon on a mission to free hostages, but instead he became a hostage. Terry was held in solitary confinement for 4 years, just imagine that, and his family knew nothing of his whereabouts, whether he was dead or alive. Now, you might remember Terry's release making big news in the early 90s. Well, how did he cope? And who has he become since? Those are the questions I'd like to put to him, and he joins us now. Terry Waite, welcome to Open House.
Well, thank you very much. Very good to be with you.
Describe that day in 1987 when you were taken hostage. It must be indelibly locked in your mind.
Well, I remember the day very well, and I went back into Beirut at a time of extreme difficulty. I still remember that I thought my chances of being captured or even being killed were very high. But I went back for very clear reasons. I mean, I'd been a victim of political duplicity, and I wasn't going to fall victim to that if I could help it any further. And secondly, the hostages I knew were extremely depressed, and I felt there was just a chance that something might be done. I went back. I was promised safe conduct by the captors of the hostages, and they broke their promise. And I spent about 4.5 years in solitary confinement, and the remainder of the time, up to 5 years in all, the last bit of time in company of other hostages. So yeah, it's a reasonable period of time in Beirut.
Absolutely. And that sense of betrayal by your captors, that must have been overwhelming. Like you said, they initially gave you the idea they were going to help you through, and then they took you captive. I mean, describe that sense of betrayal.
Well, at the time, I was very angry. And when I found myself in an underground tiled cell, you know, I really was angry with them for breaking their word. And I did what many prisoners do when they're first incarcerated. I attempted to demonstrate that I still had a measure of freedom. So I refused all food, and I refused it for a week. At the end of the first week, then they said, well, if you don't eat, we'll now make you eat. And so I ate. My anger had dissipated. There's just a small point about that. I mean, I think anger's a normal human emotion. We all have it. It's important to be able to control it, obviously. But it's even more important not to allow it to turn to bitterness, because I think bitterness is like a cancer that enters the soul. It does more harm to those who hold it than against those whom it's held. Mm-hmm. So I was able to manage that. And, of course, as the years go by, I can understand why these chaps, why my kidnappers behaved as they did. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with kidnapping. But I can see that when some people have always been at the bottom of the heap, politically, economically, socially, when they've always been pushed against the wall, when they've been ignored, when they have seen nothing but warfare, when they feel they've been totally exploited, why they turn to desperate measures.
Yes. Terry, how long did you initially think you were going to be held for?
Well, again, like most people who are captured, you feel as though, well, this will be over in 24 hours. And then you feel, when 24 hours have gone, well, you say, it can't be longer than a few days. Mm. Then the first week goes, and then the month goes, and then 2 months goes, and then 6 months goes by, and 12 months goes by. Actually, in my case, I had interrogation for the first year. They were trying to see if I knew about what in fact became Iran-Contra, was called Iran-Contra. It's a complex deal. Anyone can read about it if they so wish. You can find it all on the internet and other such places. Mercifully, I knew nothing about that. And at the end of the first year, they were convinced that I had been a victim of political duplicity, and they were going to release me. But then they put me in good accommodation for a week, and then some event took place, and I wasn't released, and I went back into normal hostage accommodation. Again, I thought, well, it won't be long, but it just goes on and on. And what you learn to do after that, I mean, you learn to live for a day at a time, and you never believe anything until it's actually happened. I was told several times, oh, you'll be gone in a few days, and, you know, the days go by, so you live each day as it comes.
Wow. Terry Waite is our guest on Open House tonight. He was a hostage back in the 80s and certainly has learnt some quite amazing lessons through that. Terry, just speak about that political duplicity, just briefly, just so we can get the story. What was the duplicity you were talking about there?
Well, my way in those days of working for hostage release was to have face-to-face contact with hostage takers. So, for example, I was effective in bringing the release of hostages in Iran at the time of the Iranian Revolution. I was able to get them home. I had face-to-face encounters with Colonel Gaddafi. And years before, when I was a comparatively young man, I had face-to-face dealings with the last king of Scotland.
Oh,
you
did
know
you?
Who that is.
Idi Amin.
Idi Amin. In Uganda. So, you know, I've met a varied group of characters. But my way of dealing has always been to have a face-to-face encounter, try and build up a relationship of trust, and try and get to the underlying issues. Why is it you're behaving as you're behaving? And then to try and find a way of resolving the problem without violence or without breaking the law or without payment. And as I say, in all those instances I've mentioned, I was successful. In Lebanon, what happened was that I had a relationship with the captors and was meeting with them on a fairly regular basis. Unfortunately, the American administration had another line altogether. They went to Iran. Iran at the time was fighting the Iran-Iraq war. They went to Iran and they said to Iran, if you will pressure your clients, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Hezbollah were the group who were keeping me eventually, but they were keeping hostages. They said, if you go to Hezbollah in Lebanon and pressure them to release hostages, then we will give you arms to fight the war against Iraq. They agreed to that. Arms were delivered. Slight pressure was applied. One hostage was released. And that, I think, came as a major surprise to Hezbollah. And then Hezbollah said, well, Terry Waite, he knows the Americans. We'll take him and see what he knows about this deal. And, of course, that's why I was captured, and that was the whole essence of my interrogation.
Wow.
And that's what I mean by the falling victim to political duplicity there.
Yes, a tangled web. So here you are in solitary confinement for 4.5 years. How on earth do you cope with being by yourself for that amount of time?
Well, it is an extreme situation, admittedly, and it can be depressing because, you know, you see your skin go white because you've no natural light, you lose muscle tone because there's no exercise other than what you can do on the end of a chain because you were chained 24 hours a day to the wall, sitting on the floor in a dark room, with no books and papers for a long, long time, and no communication with anyone, and no communication with the outside world. I remember seeing my beard grow long and turning white. It was black. And I felt, oh, I'm getting old before my time here. But what you have to do is, when you see your physical body beginning to deteriorate, you have to learn how to live within, because you're afraid that you might also deteriorate rather more quickly than you'd want to, both mentally and spiritually.
Well, I was going to ask that. I mean, that must be very difficult. Your mind must start to play games on you.
Yeah, indeed. And you've got to be able to discipline your mind because everything is lived from within. You know, there's no external stimulation. There's no books. There's no one to speak with. No one to feed your identity back to you. So I was fortunate in many ways. I was fortunate, A, because across life I'd been an avid reader, and therefore I built up a store of books and memories and poetry and prose in my mind. And secondly, I'd been brought up as an Anglican. I'm an Anglican Christian. I'd been brought up, actually, with the Book of Common Prayer.
Mm.
And the language of that was very, very helpful, because I'd unconsciously memorized it as a choir boy. And if I can just give you an example of what I mean, you know, the colics of the church, light in our darkness we beseech thee, O Lord, and by thy great mercy defend us from all perils and dangers of this night. One of the old colics of the prayer book. Very, very meaningful when you're sitting in darkness. And that colic not only has meaning, but it also has poetry, it has rhythm, and there is a relationship between identity, language, and prayer. Somehow they help you hold together at your center. And I didn't, strangely enough, some people may find this strange, I never engaged in what is called extemporary prayer, because I felt if I did, I'd begin to sort of go down a one-way track, you know, reveal my own sort of psychological vulnerability and just get into the business of saying, oh, God, get me out of here, which isn't prayer at all. I mean, that's just being like a child. And so by falling back on that which I knew, the prayer book and the balance of the prayer book, I was able to keep a bit more balance in my mind and also maintain some degree of inner balance.
Wow. Well, wasn't there a time, though, when you did just want to cry out to God and say, God, save me?
Oh, yeah, there was. There was. But, you know, I'm a believer in this, that if you put yourself in dangerous situations, as I did, no one forced me, it was my choice, and if things go wrong, you take your responsibility. You don't blame other people, and you certainly don't blame God, you know, and you don't expect... you expect that you'll be supported, and I was supported, but you have to work for that support. You know, it's not just a question of it falling down from heaven and landing on your head. There's something in the Bible which talks about being a co-creator with God, and that involves tremendous responsibility. It really means if you're a co-creator, then you've got to be responsible for your own development, just as you've got to be responsible for development of the environment and also relationships with your neighbors and so on. You've got a real responsibility, you must live up to it, so don't try and palm it off on God or somebody else.
Well, Terry Waite is our guest on Open House tonight, and this interview will be podcast via theopenhouse.net.au. I don't want to leave the whole question of faith yet, because I think that's a fascinating aspect in the sense that you're getting nourished by these verses from the Common Prayer Book, which you hadn't even realized you had memorized. what about broader, though? You said you weren't blaming God, though, but was there ever a moment where you felt your faith challenged? You know, often at those points, that's the time where our faith is really, really put to the test.
Well, I didn't feel that, I have to say. I never felt that. What I did feel was this, that, you know, religion is a remarkable phenomenon because it attracts all sorts of encumbrances around it, many of which are just sheer nonsense. But when you're out on a limb, when you're at the extremities, somehow you try and get to the real heart of the matter and you try and cut through a lot of the nonsense and get to the real essence of belief and being. And if I put it very, very simply, and this would maybe seem too simple for some people, I could say this in the face of my captors. I could say, you have the power to break my body and you've tried, the power to bend my mind and you've tried, but my soul is not yours to possess.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there was that essential belief that my soul lay in the hand of God and couldn't be taken by others. Now, we can argue till the cows come home, as people have done across the generations, you know, what is the soul? For me, it was the sum total of me, my identity, my essential being, which lay in the hand of God and wouldn't be taken by others. And that very, very simple belief, and it is admittedly a very simple belief, was enough to enable me to maintain hope. And yeah. I think if a situation, if anybody's listening to this who's in a situation of real unpleasantness and difficulty and sickness or whatever, somehow if you can realize you're not going to be destroyed, if you face suffering, it'll be very difficult. It'd be very, very easy, and there may be no relief from the suffering. But if you can have hope behind it, you'll not be destroyed.
That's a great word. Terry, your family is back at home during these times, during these 4 or 5 years that you're in solitary confinement. What are they going through? I believe they didn't even know whether you were alive or dead or what.
No, my wife was told, someone who came back from Beirut, or came out of Beirut, I don't quite know what, and said, your husband's dead. She said, how do you know? They said, well, we've seen his grave. And she said, well, I believe it when I see it. And she never believed that I was dead, and they held on. I have great admiration for her because, I mean, we have four children, grown up now, grandchildren. But she had to keep the children and the family together and see them through school and halfway through university. And in a strange sort of way, you know, it was very difficult for them. In some ways, it's more difficult for families than it is for the hostage, because they just don't know, and they go on not knowing and not knowing and not knowing and having to live normal life with all the pressures. But we came through it, and I think, in fact, it's done us good. We're it's absolutely to say that.
Yeah.
Perhaps a better way to put it is we've refused to allow it to do us harm.
Mm.
And I, if I can go back on what I said a moment, I mean, I said that suffering is always difficult, and it is. And I'm the last one to underplay it, and the last one to treat it lightly, because it's never easy. But it, as I said a moment ago, it needn't destroy. And very often it can be turned round so that it can be creative, and you can make something creative of it. And if you look back into history, you know, you find that many great acts of creativity came out of suffering.
Mm.
And of course, the central symbol of the Christian faith is a symbol of suffering,
that's
namely
right.
the cross. But beyond that lies a symbol of hope, the resurrection.
I can't imagine the feelings that must have been flowing through you, though, when you saw your wife and kids for the first time after 5 years of solitary confinement.
Well, I didn't know my son. I mean, my son was a young lad when I was taken, and he was now a mature teenager. He's now a schoolmaster, actually. He's head of sixth form these days, but, you know, with children of his own. But
yeah.
I wouldn't have recognized him. I wouldn't have recognized him. Yeah, but it took time, you see. It took time to get together again. And the great thing is, again, if anybody is listening to this who's been through a long period of separation or been through a trauma, don't imagine that you're going to rush back and everything's going to be wonderful. It may be, you may be fortunate, but take time. That was the best advice I had. Someone said to me, when you go through an experience like that, when you come out, take it as though you're coming up from the seabed. If you come up too quickly, you get the bends. If you take it gently, you'll be fine. And that was good advice.
Yeah, sounds it. And how were you finally released? Just briefly, what was the turning point for you?
Oh, it was simply the end of a political saga in the Middle East. They simply came into the room, gave me some clothes which didn't fit. I'm 6'7", so, you know, it looks like I got wearing Boy Scouts trousers.
Ready for the cameras rolling as you leave?
Oh, they said, there's weight again, looking elegant as usual. I looked like a scarecrow. I looked dreadful.
I bet your kids were saying, oh, Dad, come on.
Yeah, come on, get yourself a suit. I said, what do you mean? That's my best suit. Got it in Australia. They all dress like that there.
Hey.
Oh, well, there we are.
Well, Terry Waite is our guest on Open House. It really is a fascinating story of being captured and then released. And now the Terry Waite of 2007. You have done a number of things. You've founded a group called Hostage UK to support families in a similar situation. And boy, the experience and pathos and empathy that you can offer them, that's amazing. How many people would you deal with, though, who are going through this? How many hostages are taken around the world every year?
Well, it's an enormous number, you know. It really is. When I just to backstep one point, when I came out of captivity, I'd been working as an envoy for the Archbishop of Canterbury, and I'd had a salaried job. And I came out, and I thought, no, I'm not going to go back into a salaried job. What I'm going to do is earn my own living by writing and lecturing, and then give the rest of the time away. I wouldn't have had the courage to do that, actually, before captivity,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, you become dependent on a monthly salary, and I thought, well, now I can manage it. I've faced that sort of a different sort of a risk. I can face this one. And that's what I do today. And, yes, Hostage UK is one of the organizations I founded. There are, I don't know how many hostages a year, but very, very considerable number. And often families are bewildered, you know, how to behave, what to do, how far can you trust the government, how far can you do this, that, and the other, what provisions should we make, should we go out there? And there's nothing like someone who's been through the experience, either as a family member or as a hostage themselves, being able to go and sit with a family and just really relate to the real issues that they face. You may have heard over in Australia, you may have heard of hostage Ken Bigley. Ken was one of those who was brutally beheaded in Iraq. And I went and sat with his mother an old lady in Liverpool. And I'll tell you something remarkable about that old lady. I sat on the end of her bed. She was in her 80s, and the news had come through that Ken, her son, had been beheaded. And she said to me, she said, you know, there is nothing that can describe how I feel as a mother at this time. And then she went on and she said, you know, but, she said, my suffering is no greater than the suffering of a woman, a mother, in Iraq, who's just lost her child. And I thought, how remarkable, you know, that lady going through all that at this moment is able to extend her compassion to someone she's never met and people she's never met in a
very gracious statement.
It's a remarkable thing to be able to say.
Yeah. Well, I can understand your work then with Hostage UK and founding that organisation, but you also are the president of Emmaus UK, which is sounds like a great charity, primarily for the homeless and those that are unemployed. Why and where did the motivation come with working with this group of people?
Yeah, well, many years ago, I went to see Mother Teresa in India, and she said to me how shocked she was to see people on the streets in London. And it is a shocking thing. You've got all sorts of people who are on the streets who are homeless. It's very, very easy to go down. It is damn difficult to get back up again into life. Very, very difficult. In 1992, I opened the first Emmaus community in this country. It was founded after World War II in France. The structure is this. A homeless person will come into a community. Not a religious community. This is not a religious organization. It's a purely secular organization. We'll come into a community of people. We'll have a good room with ensuite bathroom. And we always make sure that people have a decent accommodation. And our experience is if you give people decent accommodation, they look after it. There are a couple of conditions. They must come off the dole. That's come off government and state support. They must leave behind drink and drugs. And they must work according to their capacity. There's work on premises, workshops, renovating furniture, clearing houses. Sometimes there's a cafe on premises open for the general public. There's usually a big shop selling furniture and bric-a-brac, and they work in the shop, they clear the houses, they do all sorts of things, and gradually begin to get back on their feet and gradually get back into social interaction with so-called normal people. And it's a model that works. Mm-hmm. I've now opened 13 of these communities in the UK. We've got another 16 coming along. And I very much hope that I can get it started in the USA too. And so many people there, particularly in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco, just at the margins of life, living on the streets. And something creative has got to be done to help people back into normal life. Yeah. Anyway, that's what we're doing over here.
Well, something tells me you're going to be successful at that as well.
I hope so.
I just want to wrap up what you have learnt through your ordeal. You already told me a couple of things, but if you were to bring it down to 2-3 great big life lessons that you took out of your hostage situation, and you were a different man as a result of that situation, what would you bring them down to?
Some people have said to me, you know, you were a fool to trust people so much. Well, I trusted in a number of instances, and the result was that innocent people came home. I trusted in what, in this instance in Beirut, and I was captured. You know, there are no guarantees. But one thing I'm glad, I'd rather have a trusting nature than be suspicious of everybody. It doesn't mean to say you've got to be naive, doesn't mean to say you've got to be simple like that, but I think it's better to have a trusting open nature than to be closed up and think of everybody as being negative and everybody against you. That's one thing. Certainly, suffering needn't destroy. I believe that very, very implicitly, and I've learned that. Thirdly, try and set a few simple goals in life, and don't be deterred when things go wrong. Things will go wrong. You can't have it all your own way, and you shouldn't have it all your own way, but don't be deterred. And as for questions of faith, which I think is important, at the end of the day, as I've already said, when you're at the extremities, it's quite simple. Don't expect God to get you out of a hole in the way that you expect. But if you have faith, as I said, you'll not be destroyed, and you'll find that you can live in hope, not just for this life, but for dimensions that lie way beyond this life.
Lessons that we can apply to all of us. Terry Waite, thank you so much for your time. I think it's been beneficial for a whole realm of us. Thank you again.
Well, great, and all best to Australia.
Yeah. Good on you. That's Terry Waite. What an amazing story, hey? And what some absolutely wonderful lessons that he's taken out of that. If we can't get something out of that interview, we haven't been listening. Go back to the website and listen to it again. There's got to be something that you can get out of that. Held hostage for 5 years, now a humanitarian, president of Emmaus UK. If you'd like to know a little bit more about the Emmaus work, by the way, www.emmaus.org.uk.
We hope you enjoyed this FM 103.2 podcast. To listen to more great audio, visit fm1032.com.au.